Welcome once again to our Transitions Multimedia Studios for the podcasting series titled Original Thinking, Remembering the Source of Our Consciousness. I'm Alan Huttner, your host, along with my guest, Glenn Aparicio Perry. Glenn is the author of the book Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature, upon which this series is based. Glenn is a writer. He's also an educator, a speaker, a visionary, and the founder, past president of Seed Institute, where he organized and participated in the groundbreaking Language of Spirit Dialogue conferences held annually from 1999 through 2011. These conferences, which inspired Glenn's latest book, Original Thinking, brought together Native and Western scientists in dialogue on a variety of deeper ways of knowing. Glenn is the founder and current president of the Circle for Original Thinking, based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we are together in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So welcome once again, Glenn, for podcast number 2 in our series.
Always a pleasure to be here with you, Alan. Thank you for having me.
You know, we've talked off mic about how cycles keep coming back to some principal elements of this book, Original Thinking. And I don't know how much we talked about the dialogue series in your background, but I have a lot of readings marked off here. So I thought we'd have some fun with those, and then you can take off on them and go anywhere you want, and we'll get into dialogue or conversation. But this from the preface of the book, quote, "It took an unusual confluence of events for me to come to appreciate dialogue, for it is a practice that often feels alien to the Western mind. The first occurred when I took a graduate school class in anthropological linguistics, taught by the late Dan Moonhawk Alford at the California Institute of Integral Studies. That was in 1983. Moonhawk, who once described himself as standing at the lonely intersection of consciousness, linguistics, Native America, and quantum physics, included all of the above in his class." And then you go on to say, about 10 years later, Moonhawk was invited to participate in a unique and historic series of dialogues. The inspiration for the dialogues came from the former director of Native Studies at Harvard University, Leroy Littlebear, who had been quietly observing that quantum theory was beginning to bring the Western science worldview into alignment with the Blackfoot worldview. Both cutting-edge quantum theory and the traditional Blackfoot worldview saw everything in the cosmos as being in dynamic flux. Little Bear also sensed that David Bohm, a brilliant visionary physicist, would be more open to listening to a Native viewpoint than most Western scientists, as Bohm had an appreciation for dialogue that was similar to Native circles. So I gave a lot of information there. I want you to speak about this problem in Western scientific thought and indigenous Native natural thinking and noun orientation, as David Bohm described it. I know you've brought his name up to me many times over the years. I think he's one of your mentors. So maybe, you know, and also Leroy Littlebear, helping to bridge the world of science and Native thought or consciousness as a dialogue moderator. So maybe you speak about dialogues and the importance of their principles that preceded maybe you even starting this long series that you were the founder of, which was the dialogues in Albuquerque. So,
Well, that's a big subject. The dialogues began in 1992, which was when Leroy Littlebear and David Peet approached David Bohm, and they got them rolling, and I came into the picture 7 years later. Dialogue itself is an amazing tool, and I did say that it's something that feels alien to the Western mind, and I think that's true because Westerners are programmed to think of right and wrong, to think of when they're in conversation, they're actually spending half the time trying to ready their response, so they're really only partly listening. And in a dialogue situation, especially under the beautiful moderation of Leroy Littlebear, things slow down. You know, it's almost like you're turning the your record player and you're making it slower turning it from 78 to 33, and you're just, and actually that's a very good thing, because now you're listening to what the other person is saying for the purpose of understanding them, rather than just to ready your reply. So too much of regular conversation is a ping pong match where we're just, and that's stimulating in a certain way, but it doesn't get to deeper issues. So then the other part of what you're bringing up is, you know, where is Western science at today? And I think it's important to acknowledge that Western science has done amazing things, but that most of those things were accomplished with a certain paradigm of believing that the world could be separated into individual parts. And that's still going on. And, you know, Western scientists are still searching for the Higgs boson. You know, they're always searching for something that's believed to be a fundamental building block, which is basically trying to fulfill the standard model of physics. But there's another way of looking at it, you know, and some of the physicists that looked at it in a different way, like David Bohm, are ones that I'm more attracted to. And those physicists looked inside an atom, and they saw everything was process, flux, and relationship. And they were kind of, you know, Bohm was kind of beside himself about how he was even going to describe that in English, because English is all nouns, all noun-oriented. And that's why Bohm created this other mode of language he called the Rheo mode, R-H-E-O, which was after the Greek word Rheo, to flow. And he basically, what he was doing was changing our language into all verbs, you know, adding ing in a lot of things. And you could, anybody could practice with this, and it's kind of fun, because what have nouns stop the world, verbs allow it to flow. That's all.
Uh-huh. It's action, I guess, too.
Mm-hmm.
I
mean, action. And really, ultimately, everything is flowing. So the model that sees the world as separate does seem to work until you look at it a little deeper. Then it doesn't.
Yeah. Once again, in this preface, you say these dialogues were meaningful and even transformational for many people, and certainly for me. But superlatives cannot convey the feeling of what transpired in those special gatherings. So let me try to paint the picture. And we're here, and I'm thinking some people out there would like to see a little more. Maybe you can actually, you know, discuss these circles, how they're configured, and what actually happened in the energetic of flow versus stagnation.
I can certainly discuss that, but yeah. Other people have a different experience. So I don't want to say that, you know, everything I'm saying is exactly how someone else may perceive it. But the physical setup, clearly, is the same. It's with one inner circle with an opening to the east, and then there's a concentric outer circle also with an opening to the east, and the idea is that energy flows in through that opening, and that really the concept is speaking for itself rather than, it's not so important about who's speaking. And when we did these dialogues, Leroy Little Bear actually dispensed with introductions by the fifth year. We didn't even go around and do introductions. And that was great, because then it doesn't really matter. We place way too much emphasis on that. Somebody's got a doctorate, somebody went here, somebody wrote this book, somebody did that, and then we should listen to them more? Well, really, we should just, seems to me, just be listening to whether it's sounds like it resonates for us. So we're just tuning. We're like an orchestra. The moderator throws out a tuning fork instrument, and then everybody starts to resonate, and even just the description of what the process is that happens, and then energy flows in the room. Now some people like Joseph Rael, who was a real seer or mystic, used to actually describe the thought forms that were flowing through the room, and the colors and things that he saw that were merging and combining change. You know, I don't personally see that level, but I do feel it, and that feeling is what I really like to pay attention to.
And I get, as I'm listening to you, and a little bit about the mystical aspects of it, and like you said, I don't know how many people would be in the inner circle and the outer circle, at maybe the largest number that you remember coming together, but there's a unification going on here, not only from the dialogue, but in the silence maybe, or in, you did the om. It's a unifying sound. It has great resonance to it.
Well, that's funny you say that. I just remembered now that the very first dialogue, 1999, which I did not sit in the circle. I organized and convened it, but I did convene it by chanting, instead of om, I chanted bom. Bom, bom. I couldn't resist.
Was he there? Or
no, he wasn't. Well, he was there. Yes, he was there.
Okay, he was
His
there.
Vibe was there.
Yeah.
We asked him to come in.
All right, just building on this a little more, you also say this, that it is not an overstatement to say that during the past 15 years, these dialogues and dialogue itself have changed my life. I've learned, and I'm still learning, to slow down my thinking process in order to allow deeper knowing to come through. I am learning that the most important thing we can do is to listen to each other and to the natural rhythms that surround us. And I emphasize that last sentence. I'm learning that the most important thing we can do is to listen to each other and the natural rhythms. This has been so important that this has become your life work. And I'd like you to speak a little bit about this mission and how what you did for these 15 years and what is contained in Original Thinking as a manual, kind of an operating manual in some way for people to learn this, to be able to go to a more original thinking process. What are you going to do? What's the mission, and how is this going to change the world? And that's a big vision, but I want you to share your mission statement with us.
For the Circle for Original Thinking?
Yeah.
The Circle for Original Thinking, the concept of that is to really to remember how to think like nature thinks. So to allow what is, to pay attention to those energies that are flowing through us, to listen carefully, to modulate our energy and between each of the people who are there and between ourselves and nature. And that's really critical. So too much is made, in my view, of trying to come up with leading edge thinking, or the whole concept of thinking of a thought that's never been said before or done before. This is I think a futile exercise. So what makes more sense is to open oneself as a vehicle to what's moving through. And I feel that makes sense for the world. I mean, what we'd really like to do is to bring that kind of thinking into contemporary society, into places where decisions are made, to create a culture more that is dialogue-based and not debate-based. So, you know, what happens in a debate is that each side obviously has a fixed position and they're just trying to prove their superiority. This doesn't really accomplish much. Sometimes we select the best debater to fulfill a political office, but that's not really necessarily could be the best listener. But it could be the best orator, and it would be a lot better to select the best listener, and somebody who's actually present in the moment. And that's who I would like to see elected.
Yeah,
and I think we have sometimes.
Well, I was getting this image. I'm glad you said debate. You know, they teach it they used to teach it in university. I don't know if they still have debating teams, and they practice this, and lawyers go into the courtroom, one prosecuting, one defending, that's a debate, and the truth doesn't always come out. It's like the best presenter, debater, articulator may get a point across that convinces somebody of something, but it's not necessarily true. Whereas what I'm hearing from you in dialogue, the intention of the dialogue is to get to the deepest truth or core of the issue.
Maybe what the person is saying is true. It's not about true or not true. It's that there are different aspects of a whole. And too often we have a very polarized society. So Democrats and Republicans, like the next book I write is probably going to be on politics. And, you know, if you look at, you know, the history of the Democratic or Republican Party over the last 150 years, they're dance partners that have completely changed places. So, you know, 150 years ago, it was the Democrats who were the social conservatives. They were the ones who wanted to support slavery. It was Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, who freed the slaves. Now we have almost his reincarnated version 150 years later, Barack Obama, who, you know, came from Illinois, you know, they both were attorneys. They weren't born in Illinois. They came through Illinois. They became the president in a very divided time. And now, most recently, Obama's done his thing having to do with the, it's kind of reminiscent of the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, not freeing slaves, but giving a chance to undocumented immigrants. So the point is, each side of a debate is really just a dance partner, and it's they both hold some truth, and it's a good idea to allow those to coexist. We say almost like mayonnaise is an emulsion where the oil and the water are in the same container, but you don't try to mix them too forcibly because it's not going to work, but you allow them to coexist and you don't say what's right or wrong. And that's where real creativity, originality, as I see it, comes from. It's the embracing of that difference, the embracing of ambiguity, the embracing of this as one whole. That's a unitive consciousness that is very healing.
You're saying oil and water do mix for a while.
Yeah.
That's an emulsion.
Yeah. We want to make a spiritual mayonnaise here.
Okay. All right.
What we're saying.
We're going to break Glenn Aparicio Parry in our podcast series, Original Thinking. It is the remembering our source of consciousness. We'll come back. Welcome back to our Transitions Multimedia Studios for the podcasting series titled Original Thinking, Remembering the Source of Our Consciousness, with me, Glenn Aparicio Parry. And Glenn and I are proceeding deeper into his book, Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. As I said, you know, excellent work. And I know you were saying, well, we've been conversing now for over an hour, and now I just got to the foreword. But look, this is one of our mutual friends, James O'D. I know you're close to him. He's been involved with the dialogues. He's been on Transitions Radio Magazine a number of times, a sweet-souled man. And he lays something out in the foreword that I think is very important. So I'd like to read this and then turn it over to you a little bit here. So he starts out, for the last 30 years, the Kogi people, or Kogi people, have been sending urgent messages to the world from atop Columbia, Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, the world's highest coastal mountain range. They view themselves as elder brothers and sisters whose younger siblings across the planet have fallen out of rhythm with the matrix that nourishes all life. We have stopped listening to the heartbeat of Mother Earth. We are no longer pulsed by Earth's abundant generosity towards all life. Instead, we are fueling a hyper-acceleration we call progress, racing beyond the laws of ecology and sustainability to a paradise defined by the acquisition of stuff. Ignoring nature's principles for sustaining biodiversity and replacing them with manufactured goods and techno-wizardry, all leading to a world where everything begins to look monochromatic and is dangerously out of balance. The Kogi do not see this outright assault on nature in support of materialist progress as representing a final Armageddon, even as they predict the possibility for catastrophic loss of life resulting from ignoring nature's warnings about the real cost of our lifestyles. They defer to the original intelligence of nature as the guardian of all life. Kogi elders personally told me, Mother Nature knows how to clean herself and how to heal herself. Humanity must understand that nature has infinite patience to teach us how to live in harmony with her laws. So, you know, we see symptoms now of this, I think, fragmentation that you write about in Original Thinking. How will this reverse the trend. I mean, you know, this mission that we talked about in our last segment, which is very core, is to assist people to listen, to come together in dialogue, to try to see the differences and cooperate in some way. And original thinking is essential. And we're going to get to definitions of original thinking somewhere along the line, but I know you intentionally avoided it. So answer that. You know, how is this going to help us?
I think you almost have to keep going.
Okay, all right. Yeah. All right, so we are, I'll go back to, again, this is from the forward, and I want to mention again James O.D. So I'll read a little more here. The wise Bushmen of the Kalahari have a story deeply relevant to this era. They speak of the time of All Devourer. This seems a particularly apt archetype to represent the current rapacious destruction of ecosystems and natural resources. All Devourer eats up everything, including rivers and trees. But like the Koji, the original people of the Kalahari do not interpret these calamities as foreshadowing an end of the world. Rather, they provide a basis for understanding cycles and processes. And he goes on to say, we are indeed in the time of All Devourer. He shows us the trajectory of the predominant Western worldview as it hurtles toward alienation and fragmentation. We're just talking about that. He unravels our predicament of creating a world we reserve, accelerating time rather than rhythms of a deeper remembrance of who it is we really are. And as we talked about the last segment, podcast one, we need to answer these essential questions of who am I and why am I here, I think, to reverse this trend. And I think original thinking leads to that. So your perceptions and your thoughts.
This is all from the foreword written by James O.D., and I think the words stand well by themselves. He was painting a picture of both the views of the Kogi people and the Kalahari, which have to do with aligning oneself with the original intelligence of nature. And the story of All Devourer, which is the story that James likes to speak about, is certainly true, and it is apropos for our times. But as he points out, All Devourer takes in life, so eventually life will come out of it. So one of the things that I've learned from indigenous peoples who are really in a unique position to teach this is to be patient. So obviously indigenous peoples have been oppressed, and in many cases that oppression is still continuing today, where their habitats are being destroyed or attempted to be destroyed in a rapacious way. And there's so little understanding of the depth of wisdom and knowledge and complete interconnectedness of life that is there in nature, where the indigenous habitat is. And I probably shouldn't use the word habitat because it's become a pejorative word almost. But the place to be indigenous really means to be interconnected. I mean, the etymology of it is related to the Greek and disha, which really has to do with the guts or entrails of the earth. So your feeling, your whole emotion, your heart is in the land. So these peoples who have had their land sometimes destroyed or sometimes been relocated in very harsh and bizarre ways, are actually teaching patience, and they're understanding that this will ultimately not destroy Mother Earth, but could destroy ourselves, is something that we need to pay attention to. So James paints that picture to begin a foreword where he then discusses what I'm talking about in original thinking, and that's a wonderful way to start.
James also says here, as you will read in these pages ahead, Parry has a great deal to share on the kind of integral dialogue that gives full play to both head and heart, to feeling with the mind and thinking inside the heart. But our contemporary systems are not organized around this process, dialogic process, and our political processes being polarized, which you talked about in the last segment, and not unusual, the synchronicity as you're working on an article and another book. But this heart, this merging of heart and head is really important. And maybe you talk about that as how does that work? How do we go from subjective or relative egoic perceptions, which are focused in the mind and our thought processes in fragmentation, to what it means to live in the heart with the mind or in balance? And I think this is missing in our culture, in our society.
Well, the way that I address that in the book is I'm reclaiming, I call the book Original Thinking, but much of what I'm talking about in the book would not be called thinking today, because we've pigeonholed what is thought and elevated rational thought as the only thing that's thinking. And so, but for me, it's all a continuum that's emerging from the land. So, you know, like that's how language starts, actually. It's the noises, it's the sounds, it's the vibrations of a land that became language. You know, we have this very bizarre idea that language is some kind of unique human thing, and it isn't. You know, language is coming from the land. Everybody, all of creation is speaking. All of creation has a language of its own. So it's on that level that it's coming through. And it comes right through our feet, through our gut, through our heart. I mean, most cultures for the longest time in the world believe that thought was from the heart. You know, indigenous cultures, also Chinese cultures, Ayurvedic teachings speak about the thinking being in the heart. And then, you know, but the rational kind of thought is something that evolves later. So, you know, there's an unfolding which is all valid and all part of a big continuum that I am calling that thinking, because it really is all thinking, you know. And thinking, as we speak about, thinking comes from thanking, it comes from gratitude, it comes from wholeness. So the number one point that I want to make in the book is that, you know, it's that originally all our thoughts were prayers, originally all our thought was a blessing, and it is something that connected us with the world. But the part that we're calling thought now, rational thought, logical thought, that's the kind of thinking which tends to separate ourselves from the world. So it seems to me that it's better to be connected. And that's in no way denying our rational mind. It's just allowing it to flower and unfold later when we're already connected. That makes sense to me. That feels whole. It feels healing.
Yeah. Well, you may get into this in the book, where the heart is a connective point. You know, I think you talk about heart math and that research that's been done by that organization, that the heart is even more complex in some ways than the brain, and there's something in the heart that we call love, or this frequency or field or vibrational quality. And you say in the introduction, and hearing the phrase original thinking, you probably anticipate something new and innovative, and you may get it. But the title of this book is intentionally playful, and that you're saying thought is a vibration. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying the heart is a vibration, and love is a vibration. And so we're constantly vibrating, although we're not aware of it. And our thoughts create vibration. And this is really an important principle, because
stop there.
Yeah.
The two words, our thoughts, are problematic. Okay. And because
thank you for the correction.
Immediately people start to get confused, probably, because they'll think about, you know, we have our thought, you know, Alan is having his thoughts, and Glenn is having his thoughts, and the listener is having their thoughts. Actually, what we're doing here, we're participating in a field of consciousness. And thought is it to, seems to me is better to, it's really tantamount to spirit or energy. It's something that's flowing through, like we were talking about before, about dialogue. It's something that moves. So the nature of thought, what I end up doing in the book is really comparing thought mostly to water. And I gave a lot of thought to that, or water came through or some way, but when I was praying, what came through for me was that since we're really water beings, I think we think like water a lot more than we realize, because we're 70% water. And so, and don't take this in the wrong way, but we think in a circle, and it's like a hydrological cycle. So at a certain appropriate time, certain kinds of thoughts flow through, and then those thoughts they pool together like water pools together. So from a drop to a larger pool, to a river leading into the ocean, and eventually those thoughts become stagnant, and they perhaps evaporate up into the atmosphere, and then they reorganize and remix. They kind of like have a conference with other idea clouds there, and up there they, and then there may be a brainstorm, and all of a sudden a new consciousness or a new awareness comes back down to the earth. And that's an amazing thing. But for some reason, we haven't thought about thinking like that at all. And the reason is we're addicted to the idea of progress, and we're addicted to the idea of accumulation of thought and making bodies of knowledge and putting them into libraries and then teaching textbooks to students that say, this is what the field is, you know, this is biology and this is everything that's been said. And there's some advantage to that, but there's a tremendous disadvantage to it, which is that everything you're teaching then is an inert knowledge. It's not at all in tune with what's evolving or wanting to unfold. It's more about something that did unfold in the past. Somebody had some idea about it. They put it in a book. They categorized the world. And you're studying that. And so people then those students go out in the world and they try to fit the world to be fit with their academic experience. And guess what? It doesn't work.
All right. We're going to take another break here. But if I may summarize even what you said, Glenn, where you said thought is vibration. Thoughts of the past may dissipate, but they never quite disappear. They continue to matter in the present. The web of thought is vast and mysterious and falls at its own pace and becomes a pool, like you said. And you call that, the sum total of thought is tantamount to the intelligence of nature. So where are we getting thought from? What we, to go back to your correction, and let me stop you here, you said to me, with the word hour. So is it original thought? I think I'll leave it there for the break. Glenn Perry, Alan Huttner, and we're in our series, Original Thinking, podcasting, remembering the source of our consciousness, and the book, Original Thinking, is the inspiration.
Okay, I have a...
We have returned. Welcome to our Transitions Multimedia Studio for the podcasting series titled Original Thinking, Remembering the Source of Our Consciousness with Glenn Perry here, Glenn Aparicio Perry, and we're coursing through the book that inspired this podcasting series, Original Thinking, A Radical Revisioning of Time, Humanity, and Nature. And I've been having some fun doing readings, and Glenn has done the deeper commentary around it because he wrote the book. But I've also covered it from cover to cover, not only at Glenn's request, but because I wanted to. It's taken some time, and I don't remember if you pointed this out at some place along the way of an instruction on how to read this book, but they're meditations. I mean, it's not a novel. You can't breeze through this thing, you know, like 20, 30 pages at a time. Maybe you can if you're willing to invest the time, but I found I had to stop and reflect a lot on whether it was a sentence or a paragraph or a short passage. So,
well, thank you.
That's a compliment.
Thank you.
Okay. So, you know, as we talk about original thinking, you bring an important part of conversation to the book about instinct. And what is instinct? And as human beings, we're thinking our instincts are allies that complement our intellectual capacities, grounding our thinking and living nature. I don't know if we do that. You know, have we lost our ability to connect with instinct? And what is it? What? How do you define it? We think of animals.
Well, we've not only partly lost our ability to connect to instinct. There's a lot of people that believe that's a very good thing. And that's the way they identify human beings as distinct from the animal kingdom. Of course, we are animals, but still we don't tend to speak like that in our regular language. We tend to say there's human beings and then there's animals. And one of the major areas that we use to distinguish ourselves from animals is that animals operate on instinct and we operate on something else. And I find that very problematic. I feel pretty strongly about this. Because what, you know, when I try to really take it down to the ground, what is instinct? I only come up with something very positive, because instinct is what connects us to the ground of being. Instinct is what connects us with all the other critters and all the plants and the vegetables, with the elements, with life. And so to try to deny our instincts or to control them with the rational mind, which is kind of an idea that creeped in the Enlightenment period and still affecting us today, is in my view, misguided, because it just doesn't work that way. What really is happening, like, you know, is that instinct unfolds into other kinds of awarenesses. And if you try to push back instinct or nip it in the bud or chop it off or control it or suppress it, you get a very alienated, confused being. And that's not really a very good thing, you know. So
do you connect instinct with intuition in some way too? Because I know that's a part of, we don't think of, we think of intuition as different than mental, rational capacities in the human being too.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, all these words are tricky. Intuition used to mean a sacred contemplation or a meditation. Now, if you look it up in the dictionary, it means a direct knowing apart from reasoning. So again, what's happening here is that we keep separating the thought continuum into these various other things, what we call them, like an instinct or an intuition or a, you know, a gut feeling or something. We don't believe that to be thought. You know, it only counts as thought when it becomes rational, when we can write a dissertation about it, when we can speak in this, you know, erudite way. But actually, all of this counts. All of this is part of the whole. And one of the ways that, one thing that we really need to do, in my view, is to start or to stop minimizing the intelligence of other animals, just calling that instinct. So, for instance, a bee comes in and it does a waggle dance, and they use and in doing that waggle dance, he communicates to the whole bee community where there is pollen, where there is water, where there are all these vital resources necessary to those tribes of bees, and then human beings come in and we just dismiss all of that as instinct. It's just instinct. You know, what does that mean? No, it's intelligence. If we did that, if we had a human being who went out and explored and found out where the water was and where some other essential resource was for us, maybe pollen is not as essential for us, although it's used in ceremony by a lot of tribes who understand its importance.
Well, wait a minute.
Then we would call that intelligence. We wouldn't call that instinct, would we?
Yeah. This is very important because, you know, you bring up bees amongst other intelligent animals or insects. The bee is under great stress right now, colony collapse disorder. For various reasons. I don't want to get into that debate, but the important thing is whether it's genetically modified flowers and plants and the toxicity from, let's say, chemicals that are put into seeds, whatever the reason is, bees are disappearing. And it's an alarming thing because here's the connection. Our lives depend on the instinct of bees, not only ourselves.
Bees are very important.
So leads me to something a section here that you title Tacit Assumptions of Modernity Regarding Humanness. And modernity meaning what, the modern world? Is that, it's a very interesting word.
Yes, it means the modern world.
It's not pregnancy or maternity, it's modernity. All right, so it's good.
I'm sorry.
I like your writing, Glenn. You have a very amazing vocabulary, and I love the book for that reason, too. But can we address these? I'm just going to jump to number two because this is what we've been talking about. This is bullet two. Instinct is a lesser way of knowing relegated to the lower animals. And you listed these bullets to basically deconstruct some of these assumptions. So
right.
We'll play it.
Are all assumptions I do not agree with.
So I'll read some of them and you dissect it. But continuing, that instinct is a lesser way of knowing relegated to the lower animals. Not true.
Of course, it's not true. And we need to reclaim instinct so that we are reconnecting ourselves. We can do this without destroying our rational intelligence.
Okay. Human beings are the only rational animal.
Yeah, that's not true either. But the word rational needs to be deconstructed right now, so let me do that.
Yeah.
It emerged from ratio, or a relationship between things. So for the ancient Greeks, the ancient Greeks did believe that rational thought was the pinnacle of thought, but they also thought it was the most beautiful form of thought to yet arise. And it had more to do with the relationship between things and in sacred proportion, what we sometimes call the golden mean or so it was this beautiful relationship that made it harmonious. And so what's happening there is that for the ancient Greek, they're involving themselves in the world to have rational intelligence. And what happened after that is that we decreasingly did so. We began to remove ourselves from the world. And some people would point to the ancient Greeks as being the instigators of that. They'll talk about how Plato was using abstract concepts, and that's partly true. So he was talking about that there was an essence that happened before what was in the physical world. But in general, I would say the ancient Greeks were a lot more sensual than we are today. So we misunderstand the ancient Greeks by trying to say that they're the most rational and abstract society. We've just seized on that aspect of the ancient Greeks, and then we continued along that path, and then we look back to the Greeks and say that they're our progenitors, and we overlay upon them things that really weren't exactly the way they were.
What about this? The human being is transcendent and superior to the rest of nature.
Yeah, well, that's another huge topic, but it all has to do with what we were just talking about, with rational thought. Instead of involving yourself in the world, when it begins to separate yourself from your creation, then we begin to imagine that our thoughts are separate from all creation, when in my view they're actually really coming from nature. And we begin to separate our consciousness that way, and we begin to think of everything as progressing. So it becomes like the human being is progressing away from nature, and everything else is sort of static, or it's going in a circle, but only we're making progress. So what we've done is we have captured time for ourselves. And there's theorists that write about that think that only human beings have a concept of time, And that's certainly true when you're talking about an abstract concept of time, but certainly untrue if we're talking about what real time is, which is being in tune with nature, and it seems like the other critters do that just fine, better than us.
And that's one of the bullets here. Human consciousness is separate from nature, and that's our timeline. And, you know, I remember a place in my life, a place in time in my life, where for about a month, I got up at sunrise and went to sleep at sunset. Maybe lit the oil lamp for a little while, you know, just as a transition. But I never felt better or healthier than that period. Now, I wasn't paying attention to chronological time.
Well, that's beautiful. You know, when I go on a writing retreat, the first thing I do, if there's a clock there, is I unplug it or you know, and I do just like you're speaking of. I just go by the inner feeling of what it is. So what time is it? Is it time? It's time to eat. You know, one of my earliest memories, which I find very amusing, and is that my parents, when we were about like 6 years old, my sister is 1 year different than me or something. My parents asked, "Are you hungry?" And my sister looked at her watch before responding. And I said, "Well, wait a minute. What does the watch have to do with that?" Nothing, really. So like you're saying, if you just eat when you're hungry, you take a nap when you're tired, you can start to move in a very beautiful way, and you'll be very creative. It works.
All right, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. I'm still staying in the rational thought and human identity section of the book here, which is in part one. And I like that you ask a lot of questions, and you don't always answer them right away, but you're headed to answers. And this section leads off with a question: how did rational thought become disconnected from life? And you say that a key difference between Aristotle and Socrates and or Plato is that Aristotle believed that knowledge was derived from experience, whereas Socrates and Plato believed that knowledge existed a priori before experience. And this is really a good closing for this segment. Knowledge, experience, and I'll throw in a word, wisdom, because that was one of the teachings for me from my Huna teacher for a year and a half. He made an algebraic formula. He said, knowledge plus experience equals wisdom. That you need both of them together. Knowledge alone, that doesn't work. Experience alone without any knowledge, that could get you into trouble. Maybe not. Maybe you disagree. But knowledge and experience collectively create wisdom, because you've actually, it's not just in your head, it's not just intellectual, but you've had a direct experience of something with nature, with place, at a time, maybe. So
Well, I'm going to go first to what I wrote, and then I'll go back to where you came from, your teacher.
Okay.
Most people would probably agree with Aristotle, because in the modern world, the idea that you gain knowledge through experience seems common sense. But the other idea, the ancient idea, is far more intriguing and appealing to me, which is really that the knowledge exists in the natures. I'm using a plural. That's the way my friend Nancy Maryboy and some indigenous people refer to it, in the natures. And that you need to pray, open yourself up to, and allow the knowledge to reveal itself to you. And that's a very in-the-moment thing. And it's so magical and powerful that in the Western world, when that happens, we anoint that person that is the receiver of revelation often as the start of a religion. But, you know, the only revelation only means that something reveals itself to you. And actually, I think that's really what happens for all of us all the time. And the more that we can empty ourselves out and open ourselves to knowledge flowing in, revealing itself to us, the better. So the other pathway, it feels like a natural flow, but the other pathway, the one that Aristotle promulgated, became the way we have education today, Because, you know, if you think about it, education, first it started like on a very practical level. So people just watched. They just watched and learned. And still in indigenous societies today, they may just watch or just be encouraged to listen to nature, observe nature. And the teacher or the, you know, the elder doesn't really give the points, doesn't give you the, you know, the talking points of what you're supposed to learn. It's not about information. It's about revelation. But then we get to a place where we go into maybe an apprentice society, and people are watching how somebody does something, and then they do it themselves. And it's still kind of, it's very realistic. It's based on something happening right then. But then we get to where we are today, where it's very abstract. Somebody else has had the experience, then they write it down in a book, and then you learn about it. So you keep getting removed from real life experience. So now let's get to where your teacher is talking about. He said knowledge plus experience equals wisdom. Well, that's really intriguing. I would tend to think about it a little differently. I think knowledge usually stops wisdom. For most people, you know, it might be that for your teacher that worked because they put he was able to soften knowledge he was carrying with some real life experience. But I think for most of us, it's really a tricky slope when we feel we've become knowledgeable about something. We actually become very stuck in our thinking, and then we'll never become wise because, I mean, defining what wisdom is a very, very difficult thing. I did address that in the end of my book, and it's an aspect of original thinking. But I think it really has to do more with people, and I'm saying people, but it could be a dog, or it could be a cat, or, you know, or another animal, or another being, or a plant, or someone that's become wise. But it has to do with a person or entity who has learned how to think as nature thinks. That's how I think is somebody who's wise. So that person is thinking in tune exactly with what's evolving then. All right. And so there's nothing to do with knowledge, because knowledge is actually often seen, knowledge is really something about accumulating. And as Krishnamurti and other people said, boy, that gets in the way of wisdom. I don't really, yeah. It's not good.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you certainly have emphasized experience in the formula as more important than knowledge. We won't dialogue around this. It's an interesting premise that still is in my field, and maybe it's a little bit of knowledge and a lot of experience equals wisdom. I don't know, you know, and maybe it's all experience in your perception that creates. The wisdom that, you know, you have to experience it. It's like reading something in a book or reading about a food. You can read about a food. It may be delicious, but until you taste it, you don't know, so.
Probably. You know, somebody could read a book if they're reading it with an active enough imagination. So there is a kind of experience, but usually you're right. Usually it's an abstraction.
But yeah. They have had to have the experience first. So that the words in the book trigger something within them.
Maybe, but that's why, like, somebody like yourself can answer this better than most people because you've been interviewing people for over 30 years and then you've read their books.
Yeah.
And so you have a great advantage. A lot of people read books when they actually don't know the person.
Yeah.
So when you're reading the books, you have that vibration coming through of your conversations, of your actual being in the field with them. This can be, you know, everybody can do this. I mean, I think it is more valuable, in my opinion, to read books from people you know,
right.
You know, and the more people you know who are writing books, then that might be a good thing if they're writing good books.
All right. Well, which brings us back to Original Thinking, a good book by Glenn Perry, Glenn Aparicio Perry. Well, that wraps up our second podcast in the series, and thanks for joining us. For Original Thinking, remembering the source of our consciousness. Stay tuned for the next podcast in the series.